From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And Peter, do you remember this time a year ago? We were just a few months into the pandemic, and the Memorial Day weekend was really the first test of whether we could avoid large crowds and social distancing.
Yeah, I do. I remember it well. We were just sinking into the depths of this pandemic, and we came out of the Memorial Day weekend. I remember on this show talking about those images of people crowding onto beaches and into bars really for the first time. We saw that, and we had conversations predicting that big holiday gatherings like that would be super spreader events. And of course, it was true. I mean, cases spiked in the weeks after that first big holiday of the pandemic.
Yeah, well, now here we are with 40% of Americans fully vaccinated, and about 37 million people are actually hitting the road, according to the AAA. That's a 60% jump from last year. And many of us are seeing this holiday as a first, the first holiday with less reason to worry, and the first time many of us will actually get to see family members in more than a year. CBS This Morning spoke with a few travelers at Los Angeles International Airport.
I'm really excited. We've been cooped up in our houses for so long that it's really fun to have an opportunity to finally get out.
To be able to fly again is wonderful. Be able to go with really hardly any restrictions and be able to take my mom out is a blessing.
Super excited. It's her birthday, so we're going to celebrate for a week for her.
But, you know, we still cannot overstate that we are not out of the woods yet. Here is CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky during a White House news conference.
If you are vaccinated, you are protected and you can enjoy your Memorial Day. If you are not vaccinated, our guidance has not changed for you. You remain at risk of infection. You still need to mask and take other precautions.
Well, let's check in with one of our experts, Dr. Alina Nguyen, professor of public health at George Washington University and emergency room physician. She joins us via Skype. Alina, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Well, you know, we are seeing a steady national decline in COVID cases and hospitalizations and deaths. Mask mandates are lifting. Life is returning a lot to what it was before the pandemic. What's the big picture today?
Well, I look back to a year ago during the last Memorial Day, and we were filled with a sense of dread and fear for what's ahead. And actually, we were right, because certainly the worst was yet to come. But it's a very different feeling this time. Actually, I am filled with hope and optimism. I'm filled with joy at seeing friends and family again and seeing so many other people reuniting after this really difficult last 16 months. And I think so much has to do with the steady rate of vaccinations, the large number of people now in this country who are fully vaccinated. I think we have a much better summer that's going to come our way. Although, not that much has changed for people who are not yet vaccinated. So those unvaccinated are still at high risk for having coronavirus.
Well, let's talk more about that. I'm going to ask you more about that. But first, I want to talk about all the people who are at the airports. So many airports are packed. And there are passengers that have expressed concern over the amount of people they're traveling with. With so many people vaccinated, is there a reason to worry here?
Well, the risk to someone who is fully vaccinated and does not have severe immunocompromise is very low of them contracting coronavirus, getting sick, or spreading it to others. And so I would say for people who are fully vaccinated, of course, still a good idea to keep on a mask while they're traveling, especially because it's the law to do so at airports and in planes and trains and transportation. But the risk to them is low. But if you're not yet vaccinated, or if you're traveling with young kids or somebody who is immunocompromised, they should really use a lot of caution. Try to wear an N95 mask, still try to keep physical distancing, and really use all those other public health measures that we've been talking about all along.
The Washington Post actually did this analysis that found that the rate among unvaccinated people is 69% higher than the standard figures. You know, you mentioned young people. A lot of us are worried. You wrote a piece in the Washington Post as well in which you said COVID-19 remains a real risk for families with children. A lot of folks are traveling, of course, with their unvaccinated kids. But you also write that the risk of children becoming seriously ill is low. Can you say more about this?
Sure. So the Washington Post analysis that you mentioned, I think is really important. It came out last week and found that even though we are seeing dramatically declining cases of COVID-19 across the country, the risk to an unvaccinated person in some states, including my state here in Maryland and Washington State and some others, is actually the same risk as it was in the peak of the surge in January. Mm. And so the pandemic is not over for people who aren't vaccinated. And of course, that includes our kids. And so, you know, I think it's important for families to make a personal risk decision that's right for them. Some people are going to look at the statistics that say, okay, 3.9 million children have been infected by COVID-19. Over 300 have died. Thousands have gotten ill and even severely ill. But I think some people can look at that and say, that's still a pretty low risk for my kids. I want to go back to pre-pandemic normal. Others, like my family, are using a bit more caution. And we're saying we'll be happy to get together with anyone outdoors, and if they're fully vaccinated, mm-hmm. indoors. But otherwise, we are not going to go to indoor settings with other unvaccinated people who are not wearing masks and in close quarters.
Good advice for all of us as we head into the Memorial Day weekend. That's Dr. Lena Nguyen, professor of public health at George Washington University. As always, thank you.
Thank you. Happy Memorial Day ahead.
After this holiday weekend, more and more businesses will be starting to call employees back into the office. At the same time, they're trying to figure out the best way to do it. Colorado Public Radio's Sarah Mulholland explains why getting back to normal might be harder than expected.
Telecommuting to work in sweatpants has become the norm for many office workers, but that could be coming to an end soon. Companies are now trying to figure out the who, what, when, where, and why of bringing workers back into the office. So far, there are not a lot of solid answers. But one thing a lot of companies agree on, flexibility. Cindy Fukami, a professor of business management at University of Denver, says it can be hard to pin down.
Flexibility for one person is ambiguity for another. So the word flexibility doesn't typically inspire a lot of assurance.
Many companies say post-pandemic office life will retain at least some of the freedoms that people have gotten used to. And absent guidance from the CDC, they're coming up with vastly different ways to approach it. How employees will react is an open question.
You use the word flexibility when there's so much uncertainty that you really can't make hard and fast rules.
Many executives are aiming to have employees back in the office this summer, but they can already see how the pandemic changed the landscape of office work and how that uncertainty makes planning more difficult.
This is like trying to put the toothpaste back in the tube.
That's Oisin Hanrahan, CEO of Angie, the Denver-based company that runs Angie's List and Home Advisor. Hanrahan says his team is questioning a lot of assumptions about the best way and the best place to work. He doesn't think the office will ever go back to what it was.
If you think you're going to go back to exactly where you were before, which is, you know, you're going to have 100% of your people in the office 5 days a week, you know, that seems unlikely.
Julie Cheetah Brown can back that up. She's the chief people officer at Zayo, a telecommunications company based in Boulder. As of now, about 10% of employees are opting to come into the office on an average day. Zayo hasn't decided on whether to have people working 100% remote, but Cheetah Brown says they're not giving up on the office.
I don't think there are many people who are craving coming into the office 5 days a week, but I do think the vast majority of our employees do want to have some core office to go to where they can be with their peers.
She says there will be an area for people who want dedicated space to come in most days and shared space for those that want to come in 1 or 2 days a week. And there will be more common areas for things like training new hires and getting teams together.
There really aren't a lot of things that can't be done at home or in some kind of a flexible manner.
While Angie and Zayo are trying to allow for a good deal of uncertainty in the future of their offices, some companies are issuing formal guidance. Take Crocs. The footwear company just finished building a brand new headquarters just outside of Boulder last summer. Roughly a third of that space is being used now. Chief People Officer Shannon Sisler says Crocs is taking a very structured approach to bringing people back.
We felt like that was really important so we could be fair and consistent across the organization.
To that end, the company created 4 workplace personas: explorers, collaborators, connectors, and residents. Explorers will basically be fully remote, while residents will be in the office full-time. Collaborators and connectors, which is most of the corporate staff, will be in the office 2 to 3 days a week.
There absolutely will be questions as to how we've aligned the roles. And one of the things we've done is really prepared frequently asked questions and talking points for all of our people managers so they can sit down and explain the decision making.
As companies roll out their plans for bringing workers back in, University of Denver professor Cindy Fukami says they have to think seriously about issues of equity and fairness. There are a lot more questions beyond when to reopen their doors, like who has to come into the office? Will proof of vaccinations be required? Is a particular policy disproportionately impacting people with young children? And is commuting every day worth the climate impact? Zayo's Cheetah Brown says the best thing companies can do is be ready to change their plans.
I don't think anyone really knows what's going to happen in 2022 and beyond. We just want to be as prepared as possible.
After a year in uncharted waters during the pandemic, most companies are simply trying to find the best way forward. For Here and Now, I'm Sarah Mulholland.
A few weeks ago, we told you about a battle in Los Angeles over how to house the thousands of people experiencing homelessness in Skid Row. A judge recently ordered that the city and the county must offer housing to everyone there by October. And some supporters of the order say building more shelters is the first step in getting people off the streets. But others argue that's only a temporary solution. They want to see more efforts like Project Home Key, a California program that converts old hotels into long-term housing. Saul Gonzalez has visited some of these sites. He's co-host of KQED's statewide program, The California Report. And Saul, L.A. County filed an appeal to that judge's ruling. An appellate court has put the case on pause for now, but the debate continues about exactly how to house the homeless. Tell us more about this program and how it got started in California.
Project Home Key actually had an earlier iteration, which started last year during the early days of the pandemic, called Project Room Key. And Project Room Key was about renting hotel and motel rooms short term as a place where the homeless can go to protect them from COVID. But authorities quickly asked themselves, why are we renting these places short term when we can buy hotels, motels, vacant apartment buildings, renovate them, and put people into this kind of housing long term? So far, the state and local governments have acquired more than 90 properties. That's across California, about a third of them here in the greater Los Angeles area. And they hope to house just over 6,000 people in them.
You know what's interesting is I reported on Skid Row. I learned about the history of the area, that there was a time many decades ago when there were more hotels there and people were staying in these cheap short-term hotels as housing. What are the advantages of Home Key versus some of the other housing initiatives in California for the homeless?
I can answer that in two words, Tanya. Time and money. It is colossally expensive to build low-income homeless housing here in the Los Angeles area, like $500,000 a unit to get people into a room. And then it takes years to do it. So it's much faster to just renovate those and get people in. And it's also much cheaper, like more than 50% cheaper. I talked about these issues with Dave Grunewald. He's the vice president of a nonprofit housing company involved and renovating Project Home Key sites, and he was over the moon about its potential.
It is the most successful program to date in my 30 years of doing housing for homeless folks that I've seen, getting people directly off the streets immediately into decent housing. We were up and running in 3 months. This motel was up and running in 3 months, and then we were able to house people immediately. A typical affordable housing new construction project for permanent housing could take as long as 5 to 7 years to get up and running. And in the meantime, people are still living on the streets.
Okay, with everything, I'm thinking about the money for this. What's ahead for Home Key?
Well, the governor wants to spend billions of dollars more on purchasing new sites. He thinks there's huge potential here for Project Home Key. there are some concerns, namely, hey, along with that money, we need money to make sure that we can keep providing homeless support services like, you know, psychological counseling, anger management, drug addiction services. What would be terrible here, Tanya, is, you know, you take somebody off the streets of L.A. or San Francisco or Sacramento, that you move them into a motel or hotel for a bit of time. You don't provide those services long term. And where do they end up? Back on the streets.
Mm-hmm. This really brings up for me, though, how we started this conversation, because many homelessness advocates are having this argument over shelters versus this type of housing that you're talking about. On one hand, they're saying, hey, we need immediate shelter for people to get them off the streets, and shelters are a way to do this. And then others are saying, we need to be thinking about some long-term solutions like HomeKey. Is this the solution to California's homelessness crisis?
Well, is it the solution? No, because we got 150,000 plus homeless people in California. But is it a solution? Possibly. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, when you talk to the actual people moving into the HomeKey sites, they are very happy to be there. One of the people I met who just moved into a HomeKey project, which is run by a local group called the People Concerned, is Veronica Marmion. This is what she told me.
When you're homeless, you become very humble. Very, very humble. So now that I'm here, I appreciate everything that they do. The room, I have a bed, I can take a shower. The little things that people probably just take for granted is like no big deal. It is a big deal for us. Even to wash our clothes. Now I have clean clothes all the time. I went through a lot of difficult times with just being in the street and just trying to find my way, and I couldn't do it. I knew I needed help. And if it wasn't for them, I don't know where I'd be, because I've never heard of anybody helping the homeless like this, because I used to dream of it and hope somebody would come and get us housing, but that was something that was in my head. And when I come in here, it feels so good to me. It feels really good.
Mm. Saul, what Veronica is saying is really powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just shows the need that is out there, and probably how the homeless crisis in the state is going to need to be attacked in a variety of ways. Project HomeKey is one way. It seems to have gotten off to a good start, and we'll see what happens in the coming weeks and months and years.
That's Saul Gonzalez of the California Report for KQED. Thank you so much, Saul, for your reporting.
Thank you, Tanya. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
To another crisis now, the coastal communities around New Orleans are threatened by sea level rise, but Louisiana has a plan to reroute the Mississippi River and restore the wetlands that buffer the coast against storms and flooding. Jesse Remedios from member station WBUR tells us that the plan's success depends in part on a research lab in Massachusetts.
Mark Twain called it the magnificent Mississippi. He said that the river will always have its own way. No engineering skill can persuade it to do otherwise. Garrett Dunn is doing his best anyways.
You wouldn't think seeing through 6 inches of water is hard until it's moving.
Dunn is submerged in the river's water, on his hands and knees, combing through heaps of river rocks.
Moving this wall is about 10 minutes a piece. The other wall is a little bit larger, a little bit harder to move, so it's 15 to 20 minutes.
The wall he's rebuilding is called a sediment diversion. It's designed to pull water and a whole lot of sand out of the river and into Louisiana's Barataria Bay to rebuild vast swaths of drowning wetlands. Except Dunn's not actually in Louisiana. He's in a lab in his hometown of Holden, Massachusetts, part of a team working on the campus of Alden Research Lab.
This is the oldest continuously operating hydraulics lab in North America.
That's Dan Gessler, Alden Labs' senior vice president.
There's not very many labs in the United States that can do this kind of work, especially at the scale that was required here.
Gessler says that back when the lab was founded in 1894, everything was done outdoors with water from a nearby pond. That water still runs through the property. But today, most work happens indoors, inside Alden's more than 20 buildings.
So where are we going? What's down here? Down here are some of the other buildings.
Oh,
there's a couple of them that are really cool.
Inside each of the buildings are teams of engineers. Some are constructing dams. Others are reassembling pipes. They're all studying the same basic issue.
We specialize in looking at how the water interacts with the built environment.
The lab tests water pumps, vents, systems that keep fish out of power plants. They're even working out the kinks to how water flows through the next generation of nuclear reactors. Gessler says that their largest project is that physical model of a portion of the Mississippi River, shrunken down to fit inside a building the size of a football field.
This particular model needed a building that was 300 feet long, and Alden is one of the few buildings that can do that.
Alden Lab has gone to great lengths to ensure that everything, the water levels, the diversion, the sand, the barge parked slightly upriver, is exactly 1/65 its real-world size.
The only thing we're not correctly modeling is the water temperature. That water is cold. I have to imagine the Mississippi is a little warmer.
That's Garrett Dunn again. He's the project's testing engineer. It's his job to climb in and out of the water a dozen times a day to disassemble, readjust, and then test different angles of the diversion's wall to figure out which version pulls the most sediment out of the river. Dunn's about 6 feet tall, but he looks like a giant monster next to the miniatures.
Do you ever feel like Godzilla? Or
hard to not feel like it, yeah.
When Dunn finishes setting up the gate, he hops out of the river and walks over to a computer, dripping a trail of water behind. He takes a seat and starts an experiment, releasing streaks of Christmas-colored dyes into the river. The idea is to visualize the flow of sediment. Dan Gessler says everything we're watching has already been tested in a computer simulation.
And there's certain aspects to this that the computer models don't do quite as well as the physical model can.
The point of the physical model is to make sure the diversion sucks out as much Mississippi mud as the computers think it should, before Louisiana spends $1 billion punching a big hole in the river's levee. State officials say construction is projected to start summer 2022. Even though Dunn spends a lot of time in this miniature Mississippi in Massachusetts, he's never actually been to the real one. That may change in June. He's going to a buddy's wedding in Louisiana, and he says he hopes to meet the mighty river in person. For Here and Now, I'm Jesse Remedios.
An officer pins a 16-year-old to the ground and punches out his teeth. But are there any consequences for the cop? For the first time, we take you inside the secret investigations that show how police protections in California shield officers from accountability. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
A coronavirus variant discovered in India is threatening gains the United Kingdom has made in its efforts to tamp down COVID-19. Health officials believe that variant could be responsible for 3/4 of new coronavirus cases there. Yesterday, the UK reported more than 3,000 new infections, a level it hasn't seen since April. Here's UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock.
The increase in cases remains focused in hotspots, and we're doing all we can to tackle this variant wherever it flares up.
BBC health reporter Jim Reid joins us now on Skype. And Jim, what can you tell us about how this variant that was first reported out of India is spreading there?
It spread into this country probably back in February or March from India when you saw that big increase surge in cases in India around that time. We had what were fairly weak border controls with India at the time. It was placed on something called the amber list in the UK, which meant people had to self-isolate at home, but there was no so-called hotel quarantine, which is the stricter red list form of quarantine that was imposed on other countries, for example, Pakistan. That's how the infection was seeded into the UK, coming in through the Indian community, the British Indian community here, but then spreading much more widely. In particular, though, still focused on very specific geographical areas. So Bolton, which is a town in the northwest of England, just near Manchester, is one area that's been particularly hard hit. And they've started to see an increase in hospital cases as a result recently.
What's the state of the vaccination program there in the UK?
So as a whole, the vaccination program is seen to be a huge success for the British government. 38 million first doses of a vaccine have been given so far, and that's in a country of 65 million people. So that's 70% of all adults in the UK that have received a first dose. About 25 million people have received a second dose. That's getting on for half the adult population. The data when it comes to this new variant is fairly mixed. So we've got a group of scientific advisors here called SAGE, and they think there are two issues with this so-called India variant. The first one is transmissibility. And they think, based on the data so far, that it could spread more easily. That's the bad news. There's better news on the vaccines. So when it comes to the Pfizer vaccine, for example, there was some research out last week specifically on this new variant showing that it was about 33% effective after one dose compared with around 50% for the older strain. That's after 3 weeks after giving that first dose. So that was not particularly encouraging. But then they looked at the second dose, and after taking that second booster dose of the vaccine, the efficacy from the vaccine was fairly good, pretty comparable to the older strain.
Well, you know, here in the US, as more and more people get vaccinated, we're emerging from lockdown. Is that also happening in the UK? And how does that complicate all of these efforts?
We had a big relaxation of restrictions around about 2-3 weeks ago. But there's a further decision that needs to be made and a further target date for the government of June 21st. And that's the date to, in theory, remove all remaining social distancing restrictions. And there is much debate in the UK at the moment about this Indian variant and whether it could derail that final decision. And obviously, from the government's point of view, they're under a lot of political pressure at the moment to push through this final stage of unlocking, while at the same time having to deal with scientists who are saying, look, don't move too far, too fast on this and risk a potential third wave of the virus in the autumn.
That's the BBC's health reporter, Jim Reid. Jim, thank you so much for this update.
Thanks very much indeed.
In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott is expected to sign a new gun law that would give nearly anyone over the age of 21 the right to carry a handgun without a permit. Here's Abbott speaking to WBAP News.
And we should have constitutional carry in Texas. And you know, listen, for your audience, this is something that 20 other states already have adopted. And it's time for Texas to adopt it, too.
Texas Public Radio's Dominic Anthony Walsh joins us now. And Dominic, what are some of the restrictions that would fall away when this law is signed?
Right. So just to repeat what you said in the intro, this is about the ability to carry a handgun in public, not the ability to purchase a handgun. That being said, under current state law, the requirements to carry a handgun, somewhat similar to what it takes to get a driver's license, right? Training, pass a written exam, an actual shooting exam. If the governor signs this legislation, Texans who legally own handguns would be able to carry those weapons in public without a permit or the training, testing, and background check that a permit requires.
Here's Texas State Senator Matt Schaefer. He's a Republican and one of the bill's authors.
This bill should be called Common Sense Carry, because this bill is about common law-abiding citizens being able to carry commonly owned handguns in common public places for the common reason of personal and family protection.
So that was the Republican sponsor. We're going to speak to a Democratic lawmaker in just a moment who disagrees. But there's also opposition among law enforcement. Harris County Sheriff Ed Gonzalez said the new law would return the state to the days of the Wild West and will increase the odds of deadly confrontation with police. Do you think other cops are saying the same thing?
Yeah, most law enforcement unions and departments opposed this legislation, which is unusual for a GOP-backed measure, right? You know, back the blue has been a real rallying cry for the Republican Party over the past year. But on the issue of permitless carry, Republicans tend to politely disagree with law enforcement concerns that this will increase violence, make police officers' jobs more dangerous. And a lot of them will actually argue that the new law would make it easier for people to defend themselves when law enforcement takes too long to respond. There actually was a compromise. An early version of this bill would have prohibited police officers from questioning someone at all solely because they have a handgun. After a compromise, that provision was taken out, so officers now can question someone solely because they have a handgun. That appeased some law enforcement groups, but overall, police tend to oppose permitless carry.
And just a short while left here, what other restrictions would remain for handgun owners?
So like you said, you still have to be 21 to buy or carry a handgun. But again, this is about carrying, not purchasing. So you don't need a background check to purchase a handgun from certain private sellers. And, you're supposed to be prohibited from carrying a handgun if you've committed a violent crime. The question is, how does law enforcement know who is and isn't allowed if there is no background check involved in the process and you no longer need a permit that would require a background check?
All right. Texas Public Radio reporter Dominic Anthony Walsh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
And this bill passed in the first legislative session since the 2019 El Paso shooting, when a gunman killed 23 people in a Walmart. On Sunday, State Representative Joe Moody, a Democrat who represents northern El Paso County, described on the floor of the legislature how he waited in a room with Governor Abbott and the victims' families for news on who'd been killed.
That's the room I sat in on that day. None of you shared that experience. Not Mr. Schaefer, not anyone else in here. You know what else I shared? What room I shared? The room days after that where I was promised that we would take gun safety seriously in this state.
Representative Moody joins us now. Welcome to you. It's nice to speak with you.
Thank you for having me.
And Governor Abbott is likely to sign this bill very soon. What will the impact be in Texas when he does?
We're ultimately going to be less safe. And, you know, the proponents of the bill will tell you that, well, it says that you can't possess one if you're prohibited by law, but there's no enforcement mechanism. There's nothing here in this bill that allows us to find any way to prohibit you from holding those firearms. And unfortunately, it's going to lead to other communities across Texas going through tragedies like we experienced in El Paso.
We heard that tape a moment ago. What kind of promises did you hear after the shooting in El Paso, and who made them?
Well, I mean, it made across the board. Let's get in the room. Let's work through this issue. And I had worked on gun safety prior to this, but for the first time, I felt like there was a consensus in the room to talk about background checks, to talk about making sure that if you lie on a background check, we can prosecute you, figure out ways to promote safe storage of weapons. These are all things that people agree on, Republicans and Democrats and independents. But when we got into the thick of legislative session, you know, there was no room for nuance. There was no room for a policy discussion because absolutism is the only thing that prevails in this political environment.
None of those promises that you heard were fulfilled?
At the end of the day, in this session, we will pass one gun safety measure that says if you lie on your background check, the state can prosecute you. Previously, that was only available to be prosecuted at the federal level, and the federal government was not prosecuting it. And so now, at least prosecutors at the state level will have the opportunity to seek out those charges. But in an environment where you don't have to have a permit to carry, the opportunities to really capture people lying on a background check are going to become fewer and further between. It's important that we passed it, but it's not enough.
The permitless carry bill. How is news of that passing resonating in your district right now in a week when we've seen another mass shooting in the United States? Of course, this one in San Jose, California.
The trauma that we suffered in 2019 is one that we haven't had an opportunity to fully heal from. You know, we were thrust into some of the worst impacts of the pandemic not long after that. And now, you know, certainly as a border community, we continue to be targeted and used as a political football, even to this day. And so news of this bill on top of all of those things is traumatic. It's traumatic. That's the only way that I can put it.
Help me understand how it passed in the first place, because there's a recent University of Texas and Texas Tribune poll that found that 60% of Texans surveyed oppose permitless carry. So if that's true, how do you think it got through?
I think if you talk to common sense folks like me, I'm like most Texans, I'm a gun owner. But I believe in safety. I believe in safe storage. I believe in training. I believe in background checks. I believe that it's bizarre to carry an assault rifle on your back. That's what most Texans believe. But those are not the people that vote in political primaries. And that's why a poll can read that way, but the politics of it and get pushed in another direction.
Of course, you know Texas well, and you know that there will be people in your state and probably in your district who say that if this law were in place before the El Paso shooting, that it might not have been as bad because more people with guns could have stopped the shooter sooner. What do you say to something like that?
Well, and I'd say even more on point, 3 weeks after the El Paso shooting, there was a mass shooting in the Midland, Odessa area where someone tried to buy a weapon, was turned away, and then went to a private sale and got one and went on a rampage. And so that's the environment. They're not even going to stop at the first store in this environment, you know, in this new environment. And so when you find out that someone was not allowed to carry a handgun, the first time you're going to find out is when you're also counting bodies.
There's going to also be people who point to what happened this week in San Jose and say, well, more restrictions on guns in that state didn't stop that shooting from happening.
That approach to the law is disconnected from how we do anything. We have an entire code of penal laws and criminal laws that people break all the time. It doesn't mean we eliminate all of our criminal laws. I think that's the all or nothing approach that we need to start rejecting. There is a way to accomplish safety and protect people's rights, but also say that those rights come with responsibilities.
Texas State Representative Joe Moody, a Democrat, represents Northern El Paso County. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
This next story is about a man who decided to retire from his job as a school teacher and take a risk by moving from his hometown of Cleveland, Ohio, to Alaska. His name is Ted Carter, and this move, he says, is the capstone of what he calls a lifelong quest to overcome barriers he experienced as a young Black man growing up in one of Cleveland's most segregated neighborhoods. Justin Glanville of WCPN IdeaStream has this story.
It was 1978, and 13-year-old Ted Carter had just gotten his first bike.
It was a Huffy. A Huffy 5-speed.
Did it have a nice big seat?
Yes, it was okay. A fat seat on it, yeah.
Carter says he and his friends used to meet up and ride their bikes between their mostly Black, working-class neighborhood on Cleveland's east side and the mostly white, upscale suburb of Shaker Heights. Coasting along Shaker's curvy streets, they'd tease each other about which mansions they'd live in when they grew up. Then one morning, the barricades appeared.
All right, let's go, man.
Different people opposed the traffic control plan for different reasons. Many Black citizens felt that the whole plan was meant to restrict Black motorists from coming into Shaker Heights.
It looked like freeway barriers, but a little higher, I would say maybe an inch or two higher. And they were made of cement, so it pretty much prohibited anything in the street from going forward.
The city of Shaker Heights said the barricades were meant to slow traffic. But Carter and his friends saw something else.
I looked at it as the have and have nots, myself being a have not. And from that, we came up with alternate routes to avoid Shaker as much as possible.
But that same year, something happened that Carter says served as a kind of antidote. His school organized a canoe trip on the Cuyahoga River. And he says it was one of the first times he'd ever been out of the city.
I remember the sun reflecting off the waters and seeing the butterflies and insects buzzing around you. Just seemed so pristine, you know, and so good. They're both standouts, right? Shaker Heights episode with the barriers, it introduced me early as an African-American male, what my limitations are. So I learned that in eighth grade. And also that year, I learned that God has blessed us with a beautiful planet.
Carter became a science teacher and spent 34 years in Cleveland public schools. And at least once a year, he says he'd tell his students the stories of the barricades and his canoe trip. Reminders that as many barriers as they faced, there were also rivers, both literal and metaphorical, to carry them away from neighborhoods and situations where they might feel stuck. But as the decades ticked by, Carter felt like he had more work to do to embody that lesson in his own life. He also knew that out there somewhere was real wilderness, and he went off to find it in Alaska.
My toes are frozen. Fingers are good.
It was a scary move. It was scary. I mean, I packed up everything. I had 5 bags and just went for it.
When Carter landed in Anchorage, it was negative 11 degrees and pitch dark. He didn't yet have a job or a place to stay.
My first day, I probably spent 45 minutes out in the elements, and then I tried to increase it by 15 minutes each day.
Yep, it's 6 in the morning, Anchorage, Alaska. I'm starting my morning run.
Right by my apartment, there's a trail that goes over a wooden bridge, goes probably 3 miles into the woods, then back out. And I do it every morning, and it's so breathtaking.
We're going across a bridge, covers the creek.
I've had 3 black bear sightings. Moose here are like deer in Cleveland, so it's no big deal. You see them coming and going.
Okay. Let me go with you, Jaylene. What kind of tools did they have?
What's it might not surprise you to learn that Ted Carter eventually found a job teaching, of course, at a middle school in Anchorage.
My school is one of the most diverse middle schools in America. I have not only Native Indigenous people, but Hmong, Russian, Dominican. I did take a survey to see how many ever had an African-American teacher, and pretty much I'm their first. So we're learning from each other.
What was so significant about the African-Americans and the 4 units that built this highway?
Right now, we'll be finishing up Friday about the African-American soldiers that built the roads here in Alaska. Should they receive or should they get a monument built here in Anchorage? So that's what my students have been writing about.
I think that there should be a statue for the African-Americans that built the highway. All these men used were hand tools while others used heavy machinery.
Ted Carter says living and working in Alaska, it's been another step in overcoming those barricades he faced as a boy back in Cleveland, the ones that told him where he wasn't wanted and kept him segregated in his neighborhood.
When I think about those barriers now, the eighth grade year, I think about how time has developed me into a person where I've defeated those barriers. I've overcome those barriers. And by coming up here to Alaska, it's just a breath of fresh air up here. I'm just moving freely, chasing nature's beauty and enjoying it.
What's next for Carter? He says he may move even further out into the Alaskan wilderness, one of the most barrier-free places on Earth.
Have a great day from Anchorage.
For Here and Now, I'm Justin Glanville.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.